Welcome, guys, to another episode of Rabbit Hole Recap. I'm Matt O'Dell. I'm here with Marty Bent.
What's up, freaks?
Today is September 5th, 2018.
And the official Bitcoin price is $6,901.22 on Bitstamp right now. It's about 7 o'clock here on the East Coast.
Indeed it is. Today, we'll be talking about emerging market currencies, and they've been having a lot of issues lately. Talked about Iran mining in Iran. Mm-hmm. The recent Ethereum meeting.
The Ethereum FOMC
meeting. Exactly.
We'll hop into that.
Whether Bitcoin is fair money or whether it's not.
Got some thoughts on that.
It is. Shapeshift has recently added KYC, or they're about to.
Very interesting story.
We got Casa HODL. They've come up with a lightning node in a box.
I've been talking about plug and play for a while. Excited to talk about this.
And then we have the most recent Bitcoin OpTech newsletter where they talk about the testnet being reset.
Potentially. Conversations have started.
There you go.
So let's jump into it. I wanted to start. I picked this topic to start. In particular, emerging market currencies. Extremely volatile right now. Shout out to Wall Street Giropout on Twitter. Posted a chart. Developing nation currencies have seen the most volatility versus G7 currencies since 2009. And if you look at the chart, it looks like things are definitely getting a little shaky in the traditional markets, especially in emerging market currencies. Obviously, we have Turkey, Iran, Venezuela, Argentina.
Exactly.
Who else can be thrown into this mix right now? I feel like there's a few others.
Well, Russia had the issues a year ago or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're an emergency market.
But things are getting, I think the tinder is getting very dry.
It's getting dicey.
And it's getting hot out. This all bodes, I mean, I don't know if this bodes well for Bitcoin, but it is definitely something to pay attention to in the traditional markets, I would say. Is the volatility against the G7 currencies, and it's picking up pretty precipitously right now. And one of those emerging market currencies that is probably causing some of the volatility in that index is Iran. Some interesting news out of Iran this week, Matt.
Yeah, so they've announced that I think they're basically going to start government-sanctioned mining operations. Is what it appears to be the case.
Here's what the tweet says from Hadanem at One Block Chain.
It doesn't really tell us much.
Iranian government has accepted Bitcoin mining as an industry. P.S. Electricity cost for mining one Bitcoin in Iran is less than $200. This is going to be phenomenal.
But supposedly, so the release was in Farsi. So like, I don't understand that. But some
you can't
Iranian
read Farsi. You can't read Farsi yet.
I can read it, but I can't understand it by hearing it.
Okay,
I could read it. If it was a press release, I would have been able to understand it. But some of the Iranians I follow on Twitter the Iranian government is saying that they're going to mine Bitcoin. I'd be surprised if this is, you know, them first starting. You know, because why are you going to tell people if you're going to start mining it?
Here's something a Redditor, Adun/D, an update from Iran on the ground. Apparently, the central bank is moving into legalizing crypto trading and establishing guidelines until towards the end of September. So towards the end of this month. And this is because local fiat currency is falling rapidly. So, holy shit, we've got Iran turned into Bitcoin as their currency is going.
Well, it makes sense for all these countries that have sanctioned oil, large energy resources that are sanctioned that they can't offload otherwise. Mm-hmm. It makes sense for them to mine Bitcoin because they can basically turn that sanctioned energy into money.
Yeah.
And then they can spend it without it getting
I mean, we talked about this about Venezuela a couple weeks ago in our first episode, and now that it's happening with Iran. Is this underscored? Is there a conspiracy to keep this news underground?
I feel like it's going to be the opposite. I'm surprised we haven't started getting the next rounds of FUD narratives is going to be Venezuela, Iran, Russia, North Korea is using it to get around sanctions.
Yeah, speaking of which, we're thinking
which
about
they are. Yeah. But
and we're thinking about introducing a new segment, Freaks, potential future FUD lines that could affect Bitcoin and the social tax.
Try and preempt the FUD.
Exactly. We're going to try and preempt the FUD. as best we can. We've got a topic on it tonight, but yes.
Yeah, this wasn't actually supposed to be the topic.
This wasn't supposed to be it, but
that's true, though.
It is a good example.
They're definitely, that's such an easy narrative for them to play.
Yeah, it will be played.
Especially if then you link, you know, some type of terrorist attack and you say the Iranians funded it and they used their Bitcoin that they had in the mining operation to fund it. It's perfect.
Right? Yeah, and this is why I really push or try to tell people not to push the Bitcoin or crypto community meme, because what you have to realize is that this, if this stuff becomes ubiquitous, there's going to be multiple competing and confrontational communities using Bitcoin as a tool. Bitcoin is apolitical.
It's permissionless. Anyone can plug in a miner and just start, you know, bringing in that money. So it's, we, by its very nature, that's the value prop, and that's why countries like Iran or Venezuela can.
But I think that's also why we need to combat this community meme, because it makes an easier argument for the governments that want to ban Bitcoin because of the Irans and North Koreas of the world saying, hey, Bitcoin's a community. You're letting North Korea and Russia into your so-called community.
Right. Exactly. They're not part of our community.
Yeah.
They're helping secure the network. But we don't get to give them permission or take it away. We just don't. That's not in our power.
No. Unfortunately. Fortunately or unfortunately, probably most likely fortunately, just for the better good. It's definitely positive EV at the end of the day.
I mean, they're horrible government.
Yes. Like,
let's just be clear. They're
Bitcoin is positive EV at
right.
the end of the day.
Absolutely. I mean, for every Venezuelan government mining operation, you know, you have
a slush or something, or 20.
You have like anonymous people that are you know, just trying to make a living, and their government, you know, maybe doesn't allow it, and they have a small mining operation that is relatively anonymous, that's hard to track. It's the easiest way. If you want Bitcoin, that is, if you're in a country that has Bitcoin banned, a lot of times the easiest way is to mine the Bitcoin, because it's way easier to do that anonymously.
Well, actually, it's a good time to plug HoneyMiner, because if you're in one of these countries and you don't have access to ASIC or an ASIC farm, which you probably need to make a considerable dent in Bitcoin mining, if you have GPU or CPU equipment, you could download HoneyMiner and start mining and liquidating shitcoins into Bitcoin immediately.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why you're getting this pod later than you have in the past is because Marty had CoinEasy on yesterday. Mm-hmm. What does he do for HoneyMiner?
I think he was their first hire. I think he's like
a marketing element.
Yeah, growth. I think he's head of growth or something.
Basically,
like
HoneyMiner is an app that you run on your computer, and it mines the most profitable altcoin, and then it auto dumps it for Bitcoin and gives you Bitcoin. So you have like a small accumulation of Bitcoin, and it at scale it could lower altcoin prices and increase Bitcoin price, because you're basically mining the altcoin, selling it on the market, and then getting and buying Bitcoin with it. It probably won't be profitable for a lot of people, but it's kind of cool to, you know, just get that accumulation.
Well, that's what CoinEasy was telling me, is that they have people, one dude in particular in Nairobi who set himself up, and there might be a couple dollars a week or whatever, but that's material.
Absolutely.
And he said he came on, dropped some stats about HoneyMiner's users, and apparently 30% are from emerging markets, which is pretty cool.
It is if you have a computer already with spare cycles and you have some cheap electricity, it's the easiest way to get Bitcoin. You don't have to give them KYC information. They don't take any personal information. If Bitcoin's banned in your country, you'll probably be able to use it with just a VPN. Pretty cool.
Definitely pretty cool. Let's get on to the next topic. These countries are turning to Bitcoin because they fucked up their money, either through a crisis of confidence in the government governing over the citizens, or they messed up their monetary policy. In the cryptocurrency space, last week, a couple days after our last episode, Ethereum had an FOMC meeting and change their monetary policy. So the Ethereum block reward is going to be reduced from 3 to 2 Ether per block in the Constantinople hard fork. Matt, what are your thoughts?
I keep going back to that pod you had with Joe. Where he put it really succinctly.
With Joe Wiesenthal?
With Wiesenthal, yeah.
Check it out.
that fiat is ultimately trust in the institution that issues the fiat. And with Bitcoin, you don't need that trust because it's math. You know, there's 21 million Bitcoin. You know what the supply schedule is. You know how many are going to be produced. So you don't have to trust individuals or an institution or whatever. Ethereum decided that wasn't revolutionary enough. And they have a small group of people that are deciding key things like supply rate. And so ultimately, Ethereum's value is derived from the trust of that small group of people, right? It's they're emulating the current fiat system with a blockchain.
Yeah. And I've said this before, just like on Tales from the Crypt in general, but Ethereum to me feels like the central banking and system of conspicuous consumption that we're looking to get away from with Bitcoin. I just think they've totally missed the mark for what we're trying to do from a monetary perspective.
So basically what they agreed to is, what is it? It's a three, right now, every Ethereum block mined has a reward of three Ether.
And there's a block
and now
every 15
gonna,
seconds.
They decided that they're going to lower it to two ETH starting in September, I think. And so basically they're taking money from miners and they're preventing current holders from getting diluted.
How do you think this affects miners? Do you think they leave?
Well, it hurts them.
But do you think they leave?
It cuts their reward by 33%. Imagine if you put all this money in a mining op that's helping to secure the network and they just unilaterally decided that they're going to slash those funds. And now Ethereum community members will tell you that it was a group decision, that there was consensus reached, yada, yada, yada. Ethereum ownership is very centralized. There's certain actors that have a lot of control over the system, and they're going to make sure that even if ideally in their situation, they're making these decisions behind the scenes. But when you have the actual meeting, it appears that's not the case. You know, Vitalik wasn't in the meeting, I'm pretty sure. Lubin wasn't in the meeting. Like, these are guys that are controlling everything. You know, they're handling the changes behind the scenes. They're pushing it in certain ways. Like, there's no way that you have a mining reward reduction from 3 ETH to 2 ETH without Lubin and Vitalik approving.
It's so arbitrary, too. Like, why just one?
Well, so the price is dropping, right, as well. So it's a perfect time. They're trying to shore up the markets a little bit, try and get some faith in the markets. You know, don't sell. The supply is going to be less than you thought it was yesterday. And they did this, I think, was it late 2015 that the difficulty bomb was introduced, or early 2016?
I think it was introduced right off the bat for freaks that don't know what the difficulty bomb in Ethereum is, Ethereum's had a plan to transition to proof of stake since its inception. And the way to do this, to incentivize them to do it, they were going to create what's called there's technically a difficulty bomb in the code that makes it so it's almost impossible to mine.
That already brought it down to 3 ETH, too.
Yeah.
Like, it substantially reduced the supply curve. And it them doing that coincided with the rise in price as well, you know. So, correlation doesn't mean causation. But it's the same idea. The idea is you lower the supply rate more than was expected during the ICO or more than was expected than yesterday. And hopefully it definitely stops you from getting diluted if you're already a holder, and it increases the prices.
Can you say that when Vitalik's famously been quoted as saying that the Ethereum supply will never go over 100 million, and it's, what, at like 111 million right now?
It's a little bit over that, right?
Exactly, but...
Isn't it 101?
I think it's more than that. Debatable. Okay. I don't know. I don't know for a fact.
Should I check?
Is that you?
This is not me. I'm not ringing. I think it's music outside or something like
that. Yeah, here we got the Office theme song playing somewhere in here. Going back to Ethereum, like, changing. Again, this is just, we've shit on this project enough on this podcast in particular, but again, it's just a continuously moving goalpost, and never really achieving what they set out.
Yeah, it's 101 million ETH. The ETH. People hate when you say ETH. Well, you know, I read it online for the longest time, and I thought it was like ETH, like meth, you know? Mm-hmm. 72 million ETH were in the pre-mine. Well, the ICO. An ICO is just a pre-mine where you sell your bags before the network launches. It's like the founder gets to unload their pre-mine before it happens. So they have 72 million ETH was sold in the ICO or held by the founders and whatnot. And right now there's 101 million ETH in circulation. So basically 72% of ETH in circulation was sold or kept during that ICO Genesis block period. And that seems pretty ridiculous.
It's Ripple-esque.
Yeah.
To an extent. And then if you look at like the curve chart of the distribution of the ICO, it looks
It's a little bit weird.
It looks very like manipulated.
Gamed a little bit by a couple actors. But
looks like they were trying to make it seem more there was more hype around it than there actually was.
Yeah, I narrowed it down to basically we have four guys that control the destiny of Ethereum. You have Lubin, you have Vitalik, you have Anthony DiOrio, and you have Coinbase, you have Brian Armstrong. Those four guys, Brian Armstrong is a little bit less, but he's moving on up with Coinbase's recent acquisitions that are very Ethereum focused. And those four guys, really, you're not making any of these changes without their either tacit or implicit approval.
Well, I don't know if I would even like pigeonhole it that way, like, because they'll come back with the argument like these four people do not control it, which I agree with you to an extent. Like, I think they're
more like a veto.
Yeah,
is what I would say.
Yeah, and I don't even think we have to lean on that argument to discredit what they're doing. I mean, so they, not even a week after the announcement that they're lowering the supply schedule, Consensus tweeted this out today. This is ridiculous. We didn't even say we were going to talk about this, but I had to bring it up. Like, Infura, the company backed by Joe Lubin, who's probably exerts the most power over Ethereum, and a lot of people, since they can't download their own full nodes anymore, are depending on Infura to basically run nodes for them.
They run the majority of Ethereum nodes.
Unironically, Consensus tweets out today, Infura.io went from 20 million requests a day at the beginning of 2010 to over 10 billion requests today. So they're basically hyping this fact up that Ethereum users have to use a third-party service and that it's doing more requests than Google does a day.
Right,
so
that's what Brendan said.
Yeah, so it's even questionable if they're servicing that many requests. But the fact that so many people have to depend on your Infura, like, we can use that as an argument.
It was Google does 4.5 billion searches a day.
Yes.
The number one website on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And Infura says that they're doing 10 billion requests
today alone.
Today, so I guess per day, right? But today, maybe today's a higher amount because it was dumping.
Yeah, but again, like it totally invalidates like an argument for decentralization. Like, this is like completely centralized.
So basically, well, we're actually going to skip an order right now and go to Shapeshift.
Why is this? Why we skip?
Oh,
we
because skip Infura is going to get the Shapeshift experience soon, is what I think is going
to
happen.
Okay, so let's explain what's happening with Shapeshift.
So Shapeshift when was it founded? 2014, 2015?
Yeah.
By Eric Voorhees.
It was founded in the last like Bitcoin altcoin apocalypse.
And it was actually like really revolutionary, I would say, when it came out. Basically, it allowed you, without an account, to seamlessly switch between Bitcoin and a myriad of altcoins, and between the altcoins directly. So like a lot of times, like, altcoins only have a pair with Bitcoin. You have to sell for Bitcoin and then get the alt.
It was like a first iteration of an atomic swap, if you will.
Well, it was a trusted one.
Yeah.
Basically, you had the centralized actor, which was Shapeshift, and they would be like the little broker in between the transaction. But you could switch between any coin, or they had some tokens on there too, and any other coin that they supported. Any two coins, and you didn't have to have any KYC or account or anything. It wasn't. It went even further than something like Binance, which doesn't have KYC, because Binance requires an account. You mm-hmm. have to register an account. This was just initialize a transaction. Yeah, exactly. You just convert right over seamlessly, and they implemented it in a variety of wallets, multi-coin wallets, so you can just trade between coins in your wallet.
Yeah, and it's important to bring up the founder of this company, Eric Voorhees, I believe, who has been OG Bitcoiner.
Yeah,
was exactly. really leading the cause in the beginning with Roger Ver.
Extremely anti-state, very outspoken. Yeah,
so it's funny to see what happened. So basically,
I think he lives in Panama intentionally. That's an extraditionless country.
Yeah, so the government's
he's implementing KYC now.
He's defined as a bad actor by the government, and they're coming after Shapeshift.
Well, that was in 2014 that they defined him as a bad actor.
But still, it's still in government records.
Right.
Now they're forcing him to implement KYC, AML. He basically has bent the knee, because if not, apparently he'd be going to prison.
Yeah, the accountless exchange is now going to have accounts, and not only is it going to have accounts, it's also going to have KYC. And on top of all that, to implement his KYC, he released a utility token, I guess,
mm-hmm.
Called the Fox
coin.
Yeah, the Fox token. So if you're going to implement KYC, like, just do it. I don't know why you need another token involved.
Why get into securities fraud? You're already getting.
It'd be funny if after all this they hit him with the securities violation instead. But I would just not trust Shapeshift. It seems like sketchy stuff is happening there. The way he was tweeting was just,
very cryptic.
Yeah, he said my tweets are being watched. Everything I say is being watched. For a while, I've actually told people not to use Shapeshift, specifically because they weren't. It almost seemed like their business practice, the way they were handling the transactions, where they would instantly send out exact amounts without any kind of delay or anything, was designed so that the authorities, without Shapeshift having to actively give them the information, the authorities could track you cross-chain. And I remember, I think a couple months ago, Chain Analysis released a product that allowed you to track Bitcoin to Monero transactions and Monero to Bitcoin transactions that go through Shapeshift. And that's exactly why. It's because they set it up so it's predictable the way their transactions go. So it's like easy to track. So I was suspicious then. Now I'm actually less suspicious of that first thing, because they're implementing. You would think if he was like playing ball, they wouldn't have pushed the KYC. So I mean, but regardless, don't use Shapeshift. The U.S. Gov came down on him hard. When you're a person, you can get threatened with jail time and seizures super easy.
Yeah, no, that's boy Austin Storms. Austorms on Twitter, he made a good point. Like, what's happening to Eric Voorhees in Shapeshift right now is why Satoshi left. Like,
yeah, this is why decentralization matters. You know, this is why you need your network to be distributed. You know, so we were talking about the reason I brought Shapeshift in here out of order a little bit is because
Infura
runs the majority of Ethereum nodes. They're based in Brooklyn, or Consensus is based in Brooklyn. I'm not sure where Infura is based.
I think Infura might be based in Manhattan.
Consensus is owned by Lubin and his partners. Then you have Consensus owns Infura. Infura runs the majority of nodes. So all you need is the U.S. government to come in to Lubin and Consensus, or just go into Infura or whatever, and tell them, KYC needs to be on Ethereum. And all of a sudden, the majority of the nodes of your network are either going down or requiring some like obscure, I don't even know how they would do it, KYC type deal. You know, maybe they could bring in Vinny's scam token, the Civic token. They'd either figure out some kind of KYC way to comply, or they'd have to shut down. And if they do comply with the KYC type of situation, I think it just erodes the whole value prop. You might as well, use TD Ameritrade or Robinhood and use Cash App or Venmo.
Certainly because, more efficient.
Yeah, if you have to comply with the KYC anyway, you might as well just use these fully regulated offerings that offer you dirt cheap prices that you don't have to pay blockchain fees for, you know? So this is exactly why decentralization is important. This is exactly why having everything open source, not having central actors, you know, being robust and being prepared for this kind of eventuality when they start to fight back is you need to be ready for it. Otherwise, you're gonna get crushed.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if anything comes of it. Like they could skirt by. Who knows?
Who, Infura?
Infura and Ethereum in general.
I think it's just
like, do you think they'll?
Do you think
they'll be vulnerable via this attack vector until they transition to proof of stake?
Well, proof of stake makes them even more vulnerable because then they'll have Joe Lubin, you know, securing 15% of the network. Like, that's ridiculous. Unless something radically changes, which it doesn't seem like it will, Ethereum has already follow this path that will lead them to increasing centralization, and they don't seem to have any qualms about that or trying to stop that from happening. And then ultimately, like, they're gonna get, I mean, there's like, so the major Ethereum stakeholders, especially the ones based in the United States, are lobbying the government to try and get like a free pass.
Yeah,
short of that free pass, they are fucked. So they won't tell you this because if they get fucked, then they lose everything anyway. So they might as well just be like, we're not going to get fucked.
Yeah.
That's the game plan. They're in the hope and pray, you know, and we saw that with the whole earlier last year. I remember they were worried about the SEC decision, right?
Yeah.
They were like, please spare us. Don't, you know, that was the plan. The plan was,
that was earlier this year.
Yeah, but everything moves so fast.
Right.
The plan was just spare us. Don't kill us.
How long will Uncle Sam show mercy? That is the question.
Well, it appears that he's getting impatient.
It does. So Shapeshift.
Because they must have threatened him hard, because he's always been very anti-state.
Anti-state, yeah.
I mean, he has more to lose now because he's rich as fuck.
That's true. Yeah, so very interesting development. Air Voorhees, another tragic story, would you say? A tragedy.
He's definitely an OG. He created Satoshi Dice.
Yeah.
And sold it for 100,000 Bitcoin, I think, right?
Wow.
I think he sold it for a lot.
I didn't know that.
And he sold it like right before on-chain fees got really high. So like the business was completely impractical. I think it was like $8 million at the time or something like that.
Holy shit.
And then he launched Shapeshift, like perfect timing. He was a proponent of SegWit 2x.
Yeah, that's I think that's sort of where his tragedy culminates.
Marty and I were against, and would have been a miserable failure if Bitcoin went along that path. Luckily, it didn't. I think he said sorry afterwards.
He may have. I'm not positive.
He definitely at least paid a bet where he lost, so he's got that.
Some people are not willing to do that.
Yeah, and out of all of them, out of all the SegWit 2x supporters, you know, I think he meant well, and, you know, let bygones be bygones.
I agree. But, again, let's rope this back to the importance of anonymity for the, like...
Yeah, especially when you get rich, you know?
That, and, like, so, like, how... So, I feel like everybody's making this mistake that...
Well, neither of us are anonymous.
No. No, but we're also not.
No, we have no money compared to them. Yeah.
No, that, and we're not like running an exchange or anything like that.
Oh yeah, that too. Or, like, yes.
Building something that
we're not doing anything. I'm intentionally like
That's why I run a podcast.
I know I would have to, like, if I did any of these ideas, I would not do them based in the United States. Like, that would just be a horrible. You don't want to do that here.
Yeah. So central.
I mean, he's doing it in Panama, and still because it's centralized, they can get to you. You know, they can say, we're going to seize your assets.
So it shows how hard it is for these systems and these apps built on top of these systems to succeed. So that's what I want to highlight here is, like, you should be decentralized at all cost. It seems like Ethereum and Shapeshift are not decentralized at all, and.
Well, Shapeshift is way more centralized than Ethereum is.
Yes, certainly, but
Ethereum is getting dangerously centralized.
But something like BISC or something like that could not be taken now, which is probably similar not. Similar to Shapeshift, and because that's a more decentralized.
Yeah, this is the decentralized exchanges are going to take over. Is what's going to happen, yeah. And then you'll have the centralized ones. You'll probably have like a bucket shop or two, like Binance. That's like a nice centralized exchange that doesn't do KYC, that just hourly breaks US law and lasts for like a year or two. And then the new one pops up. And the nice thing about this, the centralized exchanges will always have the advantage over the DEXs, mm-hmm. the decentralized exchanges, because it's just a better experience. You're able to have, you know, more liquidity and the interaction for an actual trader, you know, margin and stuff like that is like a lot better. You know, one of the issues is with a lot of these dApps and stuff, specifically that are built on top of Ethereum, is when you have known founders, hedge funds, and VCs, and they're all trying to make an ROI, they start throwing out, you know, a lot of the main principles we use to make these networks decentralized and robust. So they want the ROI at all costs, you know, but then all of a sudden you end up in situations where it's closed source, or you have automatic updates, you have a central controller, you have someone who can pull back the token funds at any time. And all these things are methods to control their ROI, to make sure that they still get their return on income on their investment. You know, they want that money, and it makes them vulnerable, and it's not appreciated enough. There's going to be some type of reckoning where a bunch of these people are made examples of. And I think they were thinking they were going to do that with Eric, and he played ball. You know? Yeah.
Yes. Who's next in line?
Exactly. They're just going to go down the list. That's my guess.
Hopefully they don't have any podcasters on that list.
I mean, they shouldn't. We have literally just abided by all your laws.
We've been telling people to stay away from this stuff.
Exactly.
If you're listening.
No ICOs, no, you know, no shenanigans.
No shenanigans. But on to the next topic. Yeah. And the first of our recurring segment, future FUD lines that we're going to debunk. And this week it's actually been becoming more popular recently, I guess. A lot of people are flailing out as altcoins are falling pretty heavily right now. There's a reckoning going on. And a lot of people are pointing to Bitcoin and saying, hey, Bitcoin's initial distribution is unfair. How can anybody adopt a money? So it's been like no coiners and altcoiners, shit coiners have banded together recently talking about Bitcoin's initial distribution and how it's unfair, how early adopters should not be that rich just because they were mining Bitcoin before most people know what it is. I'll let you start with this one.
I mean, at the same time, they're screaming that Bitcoin's going to go down to zero. And you'd be an idiot to hold Bitcoin. So it's like, I don't know how you square that circle. Yeah. Well, first of all, for anyone who is a multi-coiner or believes that there's going to be multiple chains, or if an altcoin is going to take over, like, you just literally have zero leg to stand on. Like, there's none of the other cryptocurrencies, like, there's not even close. Like, how would you argue that, like, Ethereum has a better, more fair distribution than Bitcoin when you had, like, a closed group of actors, like, sell the coin before the network even launched? Like, so that's just ridiculous. And then, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, what are you comparing Bitcoin to? And the thing is, you know, it's a hard truth. Life isn't fair. You know, and we have immense inequality.
It's not a hard truth. It's the way the universe works.
You know, it's very hard for a lot of people to just, it's just not fair, you know? And there's tons of inequality around the world. There's people living with no money, you know, scraping by, and Bitcoin isn't going to magically solve that. Bitcoin just gives you the guarantee that you have fair money, that anyone who has Bitcoin provided work for that Bitcoin at the fair market value that was achieved on a free market of various exchanges around the world and various miners' computers around the world. You either put in your work through mining, which the reward is dynamically changing every 2 weeks based on how many miners there are, or you're putting in your work by...
Not the reward, the difficulty.
Going, going to work and getting paid in your fiat and then buying Bitcoin with it at what the price is. So you have a very fair ledger that is literally just keeping track of people's stored work, and everyone can participate. There's no one is barred from participating. You know, if your government bans you from participating, you can still find a way around it. And, you know, that's not Bitcoin's fault anyway. You know, that's the US dollar isn't fair. You know, gold wasn't fair.
Well, then just like, let's just bring it back to the Genesis block and how Satoshi introduced this to the world. Number one, he introduced it October 31st, 2008. So two months and 2 days before he launched Bitcoin, and then two, he introduced it to probably the only people on Earth who would know how to run it and participate in the network, being that group being the Cypherpunk. So he put it on the Cypherpunk mailing list. So he tried to make it as fair as possible.
And still most of them didn't run it.
Yeah, but we know for a fact that Hal Finney was running it within 7 days of the network being live. He tweeted it out running Bitcoin.
Horrible OPSEC.
Terrible OPSEC.
Just really bad.
I don't think he was worried about it at that point in his life.
Come on, Hal.
But but even so, like, yes, you can be mad that a lot of early adopters accumulate a lot of Bitcoin, but there was an information asymmetry there that they took advantage of, and that's how markets work.
Like, and it was risky. It was worth nothing. You put in the risk.
There was multiple risks. There was social risk, like telling anybody you were into Bitcoin, people thought you were crazy. There were temporal risks. You're spending your time on this, so there's an opportunity cost of not making your money somewhere else. And then there's, like, what's the other one I wrote about today?
The thing is you have, we're surrounded.
Yeah, and financial risk. They had to pay money to get this.
You found it.
They had to get this money. They had to pay money to get the hardware to run this. So they took risks.
Well, in the beginning, they were running it on just like.
Still. Somebody bought a laptop dedicated to Bitcoin. That was a
financial. No, absolutely.
Yeah. So like the FUD that there was not a fair distribution is some of the most laughable shit.
But the thing is, you're never, it's like the enemy of perfect is, but the enemy of good is perfect. Right. Mm-hmm. Is you're never going to have a more fair launch. The majority of the systems in our world are way less fair than Bitcoin. Bitcoin can't be corrupted. It can't be manipulated by those who are in power, you know. So it's Bitcoin doesn't exist in this vacuum, you know. And so if you want to say, if you want to tell me that Bitcoin isn't fair, I would say to you, what would be a more fair system, right? And there's
the one I propose.
It doesn't exist. It literally doesn't exist. There's like all these scenarios with airdrops to the world and stuff like that. I put quotations. You can't see my quotations. It's all bullshit because it requires a trusted third party. And then once you require a trusted third party to, you know, ID people, distribute it, figure out how you're going to handle it, you have privacy issues. You have issues with that third party taking more coins for themselves, not distributing coins to other people. It's just, you know, you have seed investors that keep private. That's ridiculous, you know. And part of that reason is what you talk about a lot, Marty, is that immaculate conception, right? The Bitcoin immaculate conception is no one was paying attention when Satoshi released it. Satoshi mined presumably about 1 million Bitcoin that he's never moved, you know, rather philanthropically of himself. And so you have this situation where that can never be repeated. We're all watching now. You know, how do you have a situation where,
exactly,
where it doesn't get corrupted?
There's so
if you
many
launch
eyes
it
on
now.
It right now. Like the fact that it was born in some mystique, like actually gives it more credibility, I would say.
I think that's,
less eyes to manipulate it at the beginning.
It's the main argument. I think in my mind, it's like one of the main arguments against any kind of altcoin flippening scenario is that you just can't repeat it. You can't repeat that, you know, Bitcoin doesn't exist in a vacuum, but it was kind of born in one.
Very authentic, right?
And I was,
wow, that was poetic.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I just came up with that.
I like that one. Maybe that will be the tagline.
Including the tomorrow's bent.
Yeah, but hey, be prepared. This is going to be one of the biggest FUD lines in the future, especially as Bitcoin continues to be successful and continues to mine blocks, and people with cognitive dissonance, whether they're no coiners or altcoiners, are going to start screaming about this distribution. So let's get ahead of it, freaks. Make sure you educate people out there and spread the message.
I don't think it really matters.
Why not?
Because Bitcoin doesn't give a shit.
That's true.
I mean, it's just if you don't want to buy in, like.
But if we can save headaches, I'm all to save headaches for people.
I mean, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, I think people should buy it sooner rather than later. I mean, it's ridiculous to say you're complaining about the fairness of Bitcoin when 99% of people haven't bought any or participated at all. So if you got in right now, you'd still be earlier than the rest of the world in this. So I don't, it's just nothing, you know, just buy. You either complain or you buy Bitcoin, but either way, Bitcoin doesn't give a shit. So you can either join the movement or you can just wait till you end up joining the movement later.
What a crazy
and
fucking
the US dollar is like the most unfair thing ever. Like it's ridiculous.
Yeah. I talked about it on Pomp's podcast.
It's all the statists are the ones who are arguing this point too, which is like the most infuriating thing ever. And also a lot of them have very short Twitter names. You know, they have like the 3-digit Twitter names. Which I think is unfair. It's a little bit ridiculous that I have like a 9-digit Twitter.
That's
name,
an unfair distribution. Right?
Why do they get? We should start. You know, there's why are we using Twitter? It's completely unfair. You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, at PT.
Exactly. 2 digits. That's ridiculous. I wish I had at MO. That'd be awesome. You know, I'm not petitioning. You know,
to restart Twitter.
Yeah, it's unfair. It's ridiculous.
That's a good analogy. But let's stay on this a little bit. A little tangential to this topic, but I was on Pomp's podcast recently, posted it today, and he asked me a question like, what's one thing that you think about that you think no other Bitcoiner would agree with you or very few would? And I was just trying to be controversial. And I said, everything would be okay if Satoshi ever moved his coins. What would you have to say to that? And let me lay out the scenario. The scenario would have to be very specific. We're in like a semi-cypherpunk anarcho-capitalist future where a lot of people are running an anon. He continues to be anonymous. He doesn't tell us who he is. And he only like uses his Bitcoin to contract out odd jobs around the world. Like, hey, I want something built here. I'll
like
pay you.
Good jobs?
Yeah, it would have to be.
Like a dam or something?
I don't know. Whatever.
Like a hospital for little children or something.
Do you think that would destroy Bitcoin if you started doing that?
Well, first of all, Satoshi is a woman. No, I'm kidding. It's probably a group of people. I think we both think it's a group of people. First of all, the most important thing is I really hope that we get some added privacy so we won't be able to track his coins.
I like that.
I think Bitcoin will have failed a bit if we end up in a, you know, in a future where
chain analysis
where there's not better privacy. So I actually have like this weird theory that he's waiting for a better privacy to get either forked in or added on top, and then once he sees like if it's added on top, it needs liquidity, so he needs like sufficient liquidity to, you know, move through like 50,000, 100,000 Bitcoin or something, but. Or if it's added through a fork in some scenario, then he'll move them or they'll move them because he'll move them into like an anonymous area. And then once he has them in the anonymous area, he can
whatever.
Then spend them at will or they can spend them at will. But I do think that they're probably gone forever.
I would agree too.
There's probably another stash that she had, you know, that has been being spent and you know, still under their control, and they use it, you know, whatever time to time. And then this stash was the, you know, the bootstrap stash that they were like, we bootstrap it and then we throw it away.
Yeah.
Just because
this is
fucking
all
hasn't moved yet. You know, you went to 32, then you went back down.
Well, that's my
to
point.
Two,
like, will it ever? Will it just
250? Then back down to 50. Then you went to 1200. Then back down to 150.
Let's say we're at a point where there is no comprehensive fungibility yet, and he, she, it, they do decide to move them. Like, would that be catastrophic for the network?
I think if they, Satoshi, was waiting this long, they wouldn't, there's no reason to, it would be short term, a very big issue price wise.
Yes.
And
that's what I said.
And it wouldn't help them either. It wouldn't help Satoshi either. Like that would, it would completely, they have a huge value. If they control 1 million Bitcoin, they have a huge value. It would completely damage it.
Yeah.
So they're kind of, even if they still have control of the keys, they're kind of incentivized not to do that. Unless there's like I said, there's some type of privacy fork. I could see a scenario where, and this is just all just this fucking is all speculation, yeah, just ridiculous absolutely. Speculation, but we're here drinking Macallan. I actually tweeted out to Macallan, I'm trying to get a sponsorship. So Macallan, this is your free shill of the day. You know, all we need is 30 bottles a year should cover it. And then we'll give you a shill of the day.
We'll give you a shill of the day.
It's our favorite liquor here.
It's very, very smooth.
So if I, there's like a weird situation where, what happens if you had like a fork where you put in Snarks or like some kind of privacy improvement, and then he moved or they moved their coins on the privacy fork, but then didn't move them on the legacy fork. Like, it would probably end up in a situation where the legacy fork would get like wrecked, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think this whole Bitcoin Cash fork happened and there was no movement. There was just sitting tight. Like, if Satoshi wanted to be political about it, still had the keys, like they had a very great opportunity to be super political one way or the other,
mm-hmm.
right? That's didn't true. Happen. So like every day that it goes on, like they're probably lost for good. If they're not, and Satoshi still has them, then good for him, she, they. You know, the price will fall a little bit in the short term to price it in. And then it'll recover and we'll continue on our march, you know?
I like that.
I mean, our friend Adam Taché told us, he sent us an address earlier today that had 400,000 Bitcoin in it and was like last active in like 2014. They like sent out the 400,000 Bitcoin in 2011, but like there were still transactions there from 2014. And it's not connected to any exchange. So we don't really, it's probably an individual like that. Satoshi isn't the only large holder, yeah. You know, and they, but their coins haven't moved. So, you know, they're probably gone.
Yeah, it's an interesting subject. It's another potentially future FUD line to think about. It's always fun to have those thought experiments.
It definitely doesn't increase the supply from 21 million. If anything, it just increases the supply from 20 million, right?
Increasing and
we've all been talking about 21 this whole time. So, and honestly, like Satoshi, out of all the people, is like the strongest holder ever. Like, not going to dump the whole million. Like, let's be fucking honest here. Like, it would be like the coins would move. Everyone would panic the fuck out. The price would fall like substantially, and then like shit would recover. When everyone was like, "Oh, he only sold 2,000 coins," you know, or whatever it was.
Yeah, we're good. Good buying opportunity if that does happen. No, that's interesting. To
only
think about.
2,000.
I don't think they'll ever move.
I don't think they're ever gonna move.
I do think we will be okay in the long run if they do move, but I don't think they'll ever move.
I like I said, I think the most believable story is that they have a separate stash, and they've been using that separate stash, and then this is like the bootstrap stash that's gone forever, mm-hmm. and it's in their own best interest that, you know, that they don't move that because
keep the
Lord it'll
going
hurt the
on.
Price.
That's to the mystique of the.
The mystique is fantastic. Yeah. I mean, you're the ultimate holder, right? It's like. I, Satoshi, gave you this dope ass tool network like a global money, and I mined a million of them to bootstrap the network, and I'm never gonna move them. It's like the most ridiculous story ever. It's religious almost, you know. It's crazy.
Are we developing a religion?
I mean, look, Jesus didn't have like a block hash of his resurrection. You know, you didn't have that definitive proof.
No, it's only in the Bible. You have to go by the Bible.
Don't trust Verify.
It's true. No, it's fascinating shit. So
that was a ridiculous tangent.
It was, but Bitcoin is decentralized because of that mystique. And because Satoshi did what he did, we are able to speculate like this. And it's fun. I had fun speculating with you.
I think people appreciate the tangent.
Yeah, I like it.
That's the thing that our listeners that want the recap in the beginning to tell them what's going to be on the show, like, they don't understand. Like, we
wing it here.
We kind of just we just kind of get drunk and just go with it.
With that being said, we do have another topic.
We have two more topics.
What do you want to talk about first?
Well, we have Casa Hoddle.
Hoddle coming out hot. This is something I mentioned in the beginning. Something I've been waiting for. I mean, there have been other products similar to it. The 21 computer, Bitseed. Bitseeds, is that correct?
Yeah, Bitseeds still exists.
Bitseeds. And then Casa just announced they're coming out with a plug-and-play Bitcoin full node and Lightning node, which is fascinating. You'll be able to buy these nodes, plug it in. Just full disclosure, I bought one because I want to experiment with
it. Full disclosure, I did not purchase one.
To experiment with. And so this is the type of hardware I've been looking for. I've always said the real long-term good play will be hardware. I've got a lot of pushback on that, but I really think, like, if we want this to be ubiquitous, we need simple UX hardware tools like this plug-and-play full node and Lightning node that Casa has provided us to really reinforce decentralization. And going back, there's been a huge debate forever. It's actually a good thing to talk about. Like, should everybody run a full node? Will everybody run a full node? A lot of people are like, not everybody's going to run a full node. And I will concede that, yes.
Of course not.
But
there's a lot of people.
Everybody should have the ability to. It's like the Thomas Jefferson quote, like, every once in a while, a populace needs to wash its hands of blood and right the wrongs of the system they've been tyrannized under. Similar mindset with full nodes. Whether or not everybody does run a full node, they should always be able to.
The thing is, you should be able to spin one up cheaply.
Yes.
If you need to.
Exactly.
And you should run one.
Yeah.
If you want to run your own Bitcoin full node, irunbitcoin.com is one of the domains I hodl. And I linked that to Stop and Decrypt's awesome guide on running one.
We'll put that in the show notes. irunbitcoin.com.
Isn't that a great domain name?
I love it.
Yeah, I'm a major, major bag holder of domain names. that and Bitcoin are the two things I hodl. But anyway, like, the idea of a Lightning node, it's both a Lightning node and a Bitcoin node. It's both, right?
Yes.
And it's basically a purpose-built computer, almost like a router is a purpose-built computer. You all have them in your homes. And basically the idea is that in, like, the don't trust verify age, like, everyone, or at least as many people as possible, should run basically their own home server, their own Bitcoin home server that's like home base. And then that way you can interact with it with your phone or whatnot, and have that same security that you would have if you were on, like, a full computer, you know, instead of having to trust someone else. You connect back to your home Bitcoin server.
Yeah. And that's, if you're going full cypherpunk, you should run all your transactions through your own node so you know that you're verifying.
Right. I mean, if you're going full cypherpunk, you shouldn't buy a node like this that is the pre-configured. Oh, so it's kind of nice from a consumer's perspective is they have, up until the point when you order it, they load up the whole Bitcoin blockchain. So you literally just have to sync like the last 2 weeks or so. That's pretty cool. So it reduces your initial startup time. But that does add an element of trust. And then they have a really great interface, supposedly, that allows you to interact with your node much more conveniently than if you were trying to go with like a homebrew type solution. Mm-hmm. And on Lightning, I assume one of the ideas behind this is that you can collect fees for routing payments.
Yeah, I would imagine.
So you can grow your Bitcoin, almost like a proof of stake type of situation.
Turn it on your corner, send some Bitcoin to a Litecoin channel, and just facilitate payments as just provide liquidity to the Lightning network, let people run transactions through your channel and get some fees on that.
Right, exactly. So like with the Bitcoin node, you're not getting a direct reward back. you're getting better verification. Yes. You don't have to trust anyone, and you're benefiting the network. So you're tangentially benefiting yourself. With a Lightning node, if you run a Lightning node, you can route payments automatically and get paid small fees. They're like very, very small fees, but they're fees nonetheless, and you get paid for them.
Yeah. There was one thing about this node that you were a little perturbed about. It should be SDD, not HDD. What do you mean by that?
Oh, yeah. So it's, well, first of all, it's $300 and includes a 1 terabyte hard drive. I recommend to everyone on their nodes that they should run solid state drives, solid state drift disks. And the reason is just they have better speeds. All their speeds are like way, 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 way faster. So the sync time is quicker, which you don't have to deal with this as much, because it's already pre-synced. And they have better lifetimes, because if you're like constantly writing to a hard drive, like that hard drive is going to degrade and die a lot quicker than the solid state drive.
Interesting.
So, and solid state drives are getting pretty cheap. Like literally, if you want to run a Bitcoin node, like all you have to do is you can just, if you have a computer at your house that's just like a regular computer, you can download the Bitcoin software and run it, and you're running a Bitcoin node. Like, that's easy peasy. Lightning nodes are a little bit more difficult right now. That's why this is extra special. But Lightning nodes are going to get way easier to run as well. But it's kind of cool that you just can just have like this little like router type thing that's in your house that's like your Bitcoin control center. Yeah. You know?
Dope product. Shout out Casa.
Oh, yeah. So Casa, should we tell them what Casa is? Casa is, their main business model is like they're
custody.
They're a custodian that doesn't actually hold your funds. So they set you up with a 3 of 5 multi-sig, where you have, I believe you have 3 Trezors or Ledgers, like 3 hardware wallets that hold keys. Your phone holds a key and they hold a key. And you're supposed to...
You never need to use them to sign unless you lose the rest of your keys. And
No. You use them to sign all the time. You keep two of your 4 keys, your phone and one of the hardware wallets, you keep available to yourself. And then you use their 3rd key to sign your transactions. And then if you want to override them, like you have 2 keys that you have like hidden in different locations, like around the world or whatever.
You're correct. I butchered that.
And then you grab those. So that they can't take your money, but they act as like an authorization point. They have 24/7 customer service. They charge a subscription fee. I think it's $10,000 a year. But yeah, it's just very interesting. If you have a lot of Bitcoin, like worth checking out. Very great team. Like their team is just top notch.
Definitely. We're pressed for time here. Let's get to the last topic.
Last topic.
Bitcoin Optex newsletter yesterday. Something that caught my eye in the news section. Shout out David Harding, doing an incredible job on these newsletters. There's a discussion of resetting Bitcoin's testnet. And I just thought this was a good opportunity to sort of introduce you freaks to a more obscure area of Bitcoin development, that being the testnet. And apparently we're on testnet 3 right now. The last time it changed was mid-2012, and people on the Bitcoin mailing list are beginning to chatter about maybe resetting the testnet and starting a new one. So this is nothing to worry about.
I mean, it's you know, so someone's using the testnet a lot, supposedly.
Yeah, there's this company, Variblock. I believe the Samurai devs were saying something about them. But, yeah, apparently they're stress testing the testnet, and it's getting to a point where other people's testnet experience is being degraded because of that.
And like, that's exactly, you know, it's because the testnet has no value. This is exactly why this is why Bitcoin needs to exist. The actual token Bitcoin.
Yes.
Is because it allows the network to operate, you know, where spam is prohibitive. Mm-hmm. Also bitcoinops.org, just to throw in another shill there. That's where you would sign up for the newsletter. You should sign up for it. Bitcoinops.org, right?
Bitcoinops.org.
Exactly.
Yeah, very good. If you're looking for some technical insights into what's going on with the development with the Bitcoin Core project specifically, this is a great...
I mean, they describe it really well. Like, pretty much everyone... Like, if you're subscribed to any other newsletters, you know, you should probably subscribe to this one, too.
And David Harding is really good at condensing everything, so this is a quick rip. It won't take up too much of your time. That was the last topic. Do we have any parting notes?
Well, I mean, just to throw it in there, you know, so this is the Bitcoin testnet. It's fantastic. It's been very useful to us. It has no value, right? And then we have an alternative
testnet. It has no monetary value. It has value in testing.
Right. It has huge amount of value, but no monetary value because we're willing to reset it at any, you know, given time. And I think the difficulty adjustment, the way they handle the difficulty adjustment is...
I think they can manually...
But then you have something like Litecoin, which is just like a straight overpriced testnet. That's like worth, like $1 billion or whatever. Just completely not worth it, you know? So just, you know, keep that in mind that we have this other testnet, you know? What's the point of Litecoin?
Yeah, who knows?
Just throw that in there.
Yeah, just thought you freaks should know. That's an interesting part of Bitcoin development. And it does have its own sort of governance structure and that there has to be a discussion to reset it.
It's a little bit.
Yeah, discussion started. Yeah, it's Wednesday night. I think I'm going to post this tonight.
Yeah, so I'm trying to get Marty to post this tonight, so that's good that he just promised you guys that.
I'm not going
to
edit anything. I don't think we need...
Also, we're thinking about maybe doing like a live type show going forward. So yeah. Like, let us know what you think about that.
Yeah, we need to get...
We're not going to ask you on Twitter, so you tweet at us if you think we should have a live show, and we know you listen to the very end of the podcast, so you're actually a listener.
Yeah, no, I love that.
That's
a good
idea, right?
And then another thing, if you're still listening, one thing that could be a huge benefit to us, please like, share, subscribe, whatever platform you're listening to this on. It really helps us get more exposure and really just helps spread the word, gets us more exposure on these platforms. A lot of competition out there in the podcasting game these days. So any help helps.
And feel free to DM us, add us anytime. You know, just come at us.
DMs are open.
Exactly.
I try to get to as many of them as possible. That's all I got. That's all we got this week, freaks. Peace and love.
Awesome. Cheers, folks. Bang, bang.